Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
Good evening, everyone. If you enjoy our show and find our research both interesting and informative, please can I ask that you consider leaving us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does help us out a huge amount. You can also find out more about us and our work by heading over to deadsouls.co.uk and checking us out. We are a small team of 3 researchers with more than 70 years of experience between us. You can also find us and speak to us over on Instagram. Just search Dead Souls Social Club and we'll come up. So, as always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. This audio presentation contains graphic details of death, violence, and controversial subject matter. Listener discretion is strongly advised. From Dead Souls Media, this is The Ku Klux Klan, Part 1. I'm Jamie Black, a researcher and psychologist, and I'll be your host for tonight. In 1905, George Santayana published The Life of Reason, or The Phases of Human Progress. The 12th chapter, titled Flux and Constancy in Human Nature, contained the following quote.
Progress, far from consisting in change, depends on retentiveness. When change is absolute, there remains no being to improve and no direction is set for possible improvement. And when experience is not retained, as among savages, infancy is perpetual. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it.
I think this is worth keeping in mind as we delve into tonight's very controversial subject. Far from glorification, our aim at Dead Souls is to share factual dark history, because no matter how difficult what has happened in the past is to digest or accept, it's extremely important to talk about it so that we can progress, improve, and never again repeat the mistakes of the past. So with that in mind, tonight we are going to discuss some of that dark history in factual and informative context. Tonight's episode is about some of the darkest, in fact. Pure hatred in the most vile form. The origins of the Ku Klux Klan. The beginnings of the Klan was a carefully guarded secret for many, many years. Whilst there were many theories to explain its origins, one oft-quoted and popular theory is that the Ku Klux Klan was originally a secret order of Chinese opium smugglers. Another theory claimed that it was started by Confederate prisoners during the American Civil War. A further theory attributed the name of the Klan to an ancient Jewish document referring to the Hebrews enslaved by the Egyptian pharaohs. But none of this is accurate. In fact, the beginning of the Klan involved nothing so sinister, subversive, or ancient as the theories suggested here. In all actuality, it was the boredom of small-town life that caused 6 Confederate veteran soldiers, John B. Kennedy, James R. Crow, John C. Lester, Frank O. McCord, Robert R. Reed, and J. Calvin Jones to sit around a fireplace during one December evening in 1865 and decide to form a social club. It also seemed that they loved middle name initials. Anyway, the location where the men gathered to create this society was Pulaski in Giles County, Tennessee. It's not far from the border with Alabama. The 6 veterans were enabled and excited by the idea of their new social club and assembled a week later, full of suggestions and ideas for their club moving forward. The men wanted to give their society a mysterious name, along with the titles of hierarchy within it. Secrecy of the organization was paramount, as to ensure a mythological status to it, the founders thought. the veteran founders also wanted to ensure that the society and its members clearly avoided any militaristic or political implications within their organizational terminology or structural titles. Thus, the head of the group was called the Grand Cyclops. His second-in-command was named the Grand Magi. There was to be a Grand Turk to greet all new candidates for admission into the clan, a Grand Scribe as to act as organizational secretary, Nighthawks are what society messengers were titled, and a Lictor to be the primary society guard. The organization members would be named Ghouls, which was kind of gothic even for the time. But the question was, what should they name the society itself? The founders were determined to come up with something dark and mysterious. The men were actually well educated, and they turned to the ancient Greek language, which they saw as respectable and official in nature, but also historic sounding too. They threw around a number of ideas, with Richard R. Reed suggesting the word kuklos, from which the English words circle and cycle were derived. It was Captain John B. Kennedy who wanted to add the word clan. They eventually, after much debate, settled on the name Ku Klux Klan on December the 25th, 1876, Christmas Day. They stylized the spelling for added mystique. It was the name and its stylization that actually bolstered the early success of the clan. There was something about the sound that aroused curiosity amongst the population of the county at the time. Even the initials of the group, the KKK, drew curiosity for prospective members, which the group began to actively recruit. Those initials would soon gain terrifying significance to many, however. Soon after the founders had named the clan, they created disguises for their members to hide their identities to the general public. They enjoyed the confidence to be able to ride their horses through the quiet streets of Pulaski in full regalia. Their ride created more of a stir with locals, and further membership grew. Their uniform of white robes with full pointed white ghost-like face masks equally fascinated the folks of Giles County, as well as terrified them in equal measure. Who were this mysterious organization? What was their purpose and aim? Word also got out that they also performed elaborate initiation ceremonies for their new members, similar to the hazing which was popular in American college fraternities at the time. The initial ceremony consisted of blindfolding the prospective new candidate, subjecting him to a series of life oaths and intentional rough handling, and finally bringing him before a royal altar, where he was to be invested with a royal crown. I refer to all candidates specifically as him, as no females were allowed to join the group. But given how females in Tennessee didn't even gain the right to vote until August 1920, this isn't so surprising for the time. The royal altar turned out to be a mirror, and the crown two large donkey's ears. It sounds ridiculous by today's standards, but the organization afforded the ceremony and its attached regalia to be very sacred to them. In early 1866, the society added new members from nearby towns and began to have a chilling effect on the local black community in particular. Their intimidating night rides that the society performed were soon the centerpiece of the Hooded Order. Large groups of white-sheeted ghouls would ride through the streets and towns in the dark of night in full ghostly regalia, and specifically paid visit to the homes of black families, admonishing the terrified occupants to behave themselves and threatening more visits and violence if they didn't. This was the establishment and emergence of their racial bias and hatred, which would quickly become synonymous with the organization. Before its six founders even realized what had happened, the Ku Klux Klan had become something which they did not initially intend. Something incredibly and deadly serious. The Klan's threats of violence against the black population turned into real acts and outbreaks of vicious violence soon enough as the Klan exercised what they perceived to be their rights and freedom under the Constitution. The scholar Gladys Marie Frey, who wrote about slave patrols in her 1977 book titled Night Riders in Black Folk History, believes it was no accident that the early Klansmen chose white sheets for their uniforms. The following story was given to her by a black resident of Washington, D.C., who heard the story from his ex-slave ancestors. She wrote the following.
Back in those days, they had little log cabins built around in a circle, around for the slaves. And the log cabins, well, they dabbed between two logs. They dabbed it with some mortar. And of course, when that fallout, you could look out and see. But most every night, along about 8 or 9 o'clock, this overseer would get on his white horse and put a sheet over him and put tin cans to a rope and drag it around. And they told all the slaves, now, if you poke your head outdoors after a certain time, monster of a ghost will come get you. They peep through and see that and never go out. They didn't have to have any guards.
Frey wrote that such disguises were deliberately intended to strike fear into the black community, and that the first Klansmen knew this. They soon began to embellish them with fake horns and paint around their lips and eyes through the holes within their masks. Relying on the oral testimony of contemporary blacks whose parents or grandparents had been slaves, Frey concludes that many slaves at the time were very superstitious, with real fears of ghosts and the supernatural. But she also added that most slaves were well aware of that, and that white slave owners and patrollers were just trying to fool them. According to Frey's research, slaves may have been frightened by the slave patrols, but they were far from defenseless. A common trick by the patrollers was to dress in black, except for white boots and a white hat, which did make a ghostly sight when a group of them were riding along through the dark night. On one such occasion, slaves stretched grapevines across the road at just the right height to strike a rider from his horseback. The slave patrol came galloping along and tore out the grapevines, with three patrollers being killed and several others injured in the standoff. There were no more mounted slave patrols for a long time afterwards in that town. After the Civil War, when the Ku Klux Klan served the same purpose of controlling blacks as the slave patrols had, many whites, and later historians, mistook the surface behavior of blacks for their genuine feelings. For blacks, Frey says the following.
Appearing to believe what whites wanted them to believe was a part of wearing the mask and playing the game. A particular instance was where one ex-slave who had heard rumors of strange riders in his neighborhood went to his former slave owner master to obtain clarity. The ex-slave owner told him, "There are Ku Klux Klan here. Are you afraid they will get among you?" The black man replied, "What sort of men are they?" And the reply he got was, "They are men who rise from the dead."
In fact, according to a congressional committee report, this informant gave the matter considerable thought, but rejected the truth to it. Frey continues,
"It is significant that the early Klan made such great efforts to frighten and terrorize blacks through supernatural means. The whole rationale for psychological control, based on a fear of the supernatural, was that white men were sure that they knew black people. They were not only firmly convinced that black people were gullible and would literally believe anything, but they were equally sure that blacks were an extremely superstitious people who had a fantastic belief in the supernatural interwoven into their life, folklore, and religion. Such thinking had obvious flaws. The underestimation of black intelligence and the overvaluation of existing superstitious beliefs.
Black citizens were frightened, no doubt, but not of ghosts. They were terrified of the very much alive and well-armed men who were more than capable and had the fervent intention of making black people ghosts themselves, well before their time. The Klan's version of history, though, well, It's that very few eras of United States history are as entangled in myth and legend as the period of 1865 to 1877. This period became known as the Reconstruction. For the modern Klansmen, and yes, there are still some around, this period of history is vitally important. The retelling of the events of those days is a basic element of Klan propaganda and their coveted oral history. The Klan version of the Reconstruction goes something like this. In the dark days immediately after the Civil War, Southerners were just beginning to pick up the pieces of their shattered lives and society when an evil and profit-minded coalition of Northern radical Republicans, so-called carpetbaggers, and Southern scallywags threw out legitimate Southern governments at bayonet point and began installing illiterate black people in state offices. As I said, this is the Klan's version of history, so bear with me. Hey guys, I'm just going to pause this episode here to invite you all, well, those who haven't already done so, to head over to our Patreon and sign on up. Our Patreon gives you access to extra episodes, articles, blogs, and research material, and all for just $2 a month. That's all for less than the price of a cup of coffee. That's a hell of a bargain, if I don't mind saying. If you're interested in joining us, head over to www.patreon.com/deadsouls. We can't wait to see you guys over there. Coming up just this week alone on Patreon, we will be dropping two episodes that I've wanted to release for quite some time. The first is titled My Story, where I share some paranormal childhood experiences that terrified me at the time and still terrify me to this very day. The second discusses the processes and procedures that my team and I use to investigate some of the phenomenon that we research. The techniques and technology we use, the science behind our methods, and also how a recent investigation in the north of England has completely baffled us with its strange and chilling outcome. I can't wait to share them with you guys. For all of you who have already signed up, thank you so, so much. We are absolutely ingratiated to have you with us. And while you are there, reach out and say hello. Okay, back to the episode. The Klan's version of the Reconstruction went on. The conspirators aroused mobs of savage blacks to attack defenseless whites, while the South was helpless to do anything about it. The radicals were pulling the strings behind the scenes, and they stole Southern state governments in the process. After a few years of this chaos, the Ku Klux Klan arose, drove out the carpetbaggers and radicals, and restored white Southerners to their rightful place within their own land. Remember this comment about their so-called own land? A land which had fairly recently, at that point in history, not long been stolen itself from the Native Americans who had lived on those lands for thousands of years. But I digress. Like all legends and myths, this particular scenario starts out with a few grains of truth, but winds up being a romanticized and entirely fake version of history that white Southerners, in the late 1800s, wanted very badly to believe was true. There were no events of this period that illustrate the inaccuracy of the legend better than the race riots which occurred in Memphis and New Orleans in the first half of 1866, for example. In both riots, white city police attacked groups of black citizens without provocation and killed large numbers of men, women, and children with the help of armed white vigilante mobs supporting them. These were the worst incidents of white organized violence against black people during that particular year, but by no means the only instances. The next phase of the story concerns the Reconstruction governments that were installed in 1867, following the abolishment by Congress of the renegade governments formed by the ex-Confederate states directly following the Civil War. Some of these newly formed governments were indeed completely corrupt and incompetent, so the white supremacists maintain. But independent historians who have studied these governments have found that often the greatest beneficiaries of the corruption were actually aristocratic white Southerners. The restoration of white governments in the South was called the Redemption, and although there are many historical reasons for the change, it was a development for which the Klan claimed credit for. The Klan thereby placed the secret society in what it viewed as a heroic role within the Southern history. The simple facts regarding the origins of the Ku Klux Klan, and indeed its revival around half a century later, which we will discuss shortly, seem entirely alien and strange to many people living by today's standards. Within just 12 months of the Klan's founding, the society blew up in popularity across the US southern states. They terrorized the black population and sabotaged the Reconstruction-era governments of the time. Extreme violence and murder seem to now be the backbone of the organization. But after just 4 years, albeit 4 long years, the Klan quickly faded into the dark shadows of history. But it wouldn't be the last we would see of them. You see, following the First World War, an entirely new version of the Ku Klux Klan emerged, and within just a few years, it brought many parts of the nation under its hateful grip of racism and bloodshed once again. Having grown to be a major force for the second time, the Klan once again declined back into the shadows. But this time, it never quite disappeared entirely. It remains lurking in the background forevermore, and still maintains a place in parts of the United States, although it has never grown to the levels of power and popularity that it once did. By today's standards, it may seem quite incredible that an organization so violent and so opposed to the American constitutional principles of justice and equality, a nation founded on immigration and being a melting pot of many cultures and peoples from all over the world, that they could twice in the country's history have held such power. But race and racism has always been and remains a significant issue in the United States. There are several key and significant questions posed here. How did the Ku Klux Klan, essentially a terrorist organization and one of the first in the United States, seize control of the southern states during the aftermath of the Civil War? Why did it do so so quickly and with such ease? And why did it decline and disappear so quickly? How could it have risen again so rapidly to a position of power once again in the 1920s, and again so rapidly have lost that power and support? Finally, why is the ghost of the Civil War still haunting America to this very day, living within the national psyche and cultural zeitgeist, and maintaining a place within its culture for violence and racism given the diversity of its society? Well, let's take a look. The answers to America's racial struggles do not lie on the surface of history. They are far more complex and run deeper than just the events of the turbulent 1960s that sets the imagery that we all have in our minds of the Klan today. White-robed parades, cross-burnings, and lynchings of black people in the 1920s. But I suppose the story truly begins on the US frontier, where successive generations of Americans learned tough lessons about survival. Life wasn't easy for frontiersmen and women. It was a world away from the industrializing cities of the time. The lessons that these people learned, however, would lead to and develop some of the qualities and values of life in America for which the nation is most admired for today. For the record, I adore America. The United States is a wonderful country, which has a rich culture and some of the nicest people that I have ever met. I enjoy several trips there every year, and the United States never disappoints. The American people are fiercely individual, extremely enterprising, inventive, and they value their constitutional freedom to be whatever person they want to be, value their freedom of speech and expression, and adore being able to go freely wherever the road takes them. Extremely admirable values. But the frontier spirit also included other traits as well that cannot be ignored. One of those was the firm belief in frontier justice, an instant, private, personal, and often very violent method of settling differences without having to involve lawyers or courts. You can understand why this was valued at the time. The frontier was sometimes hundreds of miles from any kind of law. They had to survive and maintain an order to their remote existence. As the frontier was tamed and industrialization and settlement grew across America and brought with it churches, schools, and courthouses, settlers leant more towards the older brand of private justice over the new type of law and order that grew with their civilization. There were many who simply refused to accept the new changes. The ongoing belief in private, personal justice, or what was essentially revenge justice, became a key motivation for many who later became part of the Ku Klux Klan, especially among those who were poor and lacked education. Perhaps an even more immediate impetus for the rise of the Klan was the Civil War itself and the subsequent Reconstruction era that followed. When robed Klansmen were at their highest level of power, Northerners who became justifiably alarmed saw in the Klan an attempt of unrepentant Confederates who were determined to win back their goal societal outcome through terrorism, essentially rising up to claim what they had been unable to win on the battlefield. Whilst this may have been an entirely simplistic viewpoint, it remains true that it does not totally explain the Klan's sway over the South on its own, even though there is little doubt that many ex-Confederate veterans exchanged their rebel grey uniforms for the white hoods and sheets of the Klan. Most importantly, there were the conditions that Southerners were faced with immediately after the war. This explains significantly more about the reason for the Klan's emergence. Southern cities, plantations, and farms were all destroyed. Society in the South was in ruins after the Civil War, and many people were displaced and now living in extreme poverty. They were often hungry and had to live with what they perceived to be an occupation army imposing their values and rules upon them. Reconstruction governments threatened to usurp the traditional white ruling authority. In fact, in the initial few months after the fighting had ended, white Southerners had to contend with the losses of life, property, and their honor. They were defeated, and a cultural depression led to the rise of the sentiment that the Ku Klux Klan became synonymous for. The time was ripe for the Klan's emergence. Let's not forget that slavery also played a significant part in the South's widespread acceptance of the Klan too. The institution of slavery, then the subsequent freedom for slaves, represented for many white Southerners a very bitter defeat. This was a defeat that they were reminded of daily in their economic and social way of life. It was an age-old nightmare come true for them. Early in Southern life, white people in general, and particularly plantation owners, had grown concerned that the large number of slaves that were now living among them could potentially rise up and become a potential threat to their property and their lives. It became a common cultural paranoia. Almost like they knew the existence of slavery was inhumane and wrong, and that slaves would eventually fight back. A series of bloody slave revolts in Virginia and several other parts of the South had in fact resulted in the widespread practice of authorized quote-unquote night patrols. The patrols were composed of legally deputized white men who rode through the towns to maintain what they perceived as control over an unstable society. White Southerners looked upon these night patrols as a civic and moral duty, something akin to serving on a jury or in the militia. The horseback patrols, also known as regulators, prowled the roads and towns of the southern states, enforcing slave curfews, hunting down runaway slaves, and guarding rural areas against the threat of black uprisings. They were actually authorized by law to give a specific number of lashings to any violators which they apprehended, a sort of legalized and accepted vigilante frontier justice. The memory of these legal night riders and their whips remained fresh in the minds of the defeated Confederate Southerners, but also in the minds of liberated black citizens when the first Klansmen took up newly established night patrols in the winter of 1866. Robert E. Lee's Confederate surrender was just 9 months prior, when the six original founders met at a law office during that cold December night in 1865. And then, from that beginning in Pulaski, Tennessee, the society began to emerge. In all actuality, historians often disagree on the intention of the six founders. But it is known that word quickly spread about a new organization whose members met in secret and rode with their faces hidden, and who practiced elaborate rituals and initiation ceremonies. This much is solid fact. Mischief and tomfoolery were the tactics of the early Klan. At first, a favorite Klan tactic had been for a white-sheeted Klansman wearing a ghoulish mask to ride up to a black family's home at night and demand water. When the well bucket was offered, the Klansman would gulp it down and demand more, having actually poured the water through a rubber tube that flowed into a leather bottle concealed beneath his robe. After draining several buckets, the rider would exclaim that he had not had a drink since he had died on the battlefield at Shiloh. He would then gallop away on his horse into the night. His intention was to leave the impression that ghosts of the Confederate dead were riding and haunting the countryside. The presence of armed white men roving the countryside at night reminded many black people at the time of the pre-war slave patrols. But then that quickly became the Klan's intention. The fact that the Klansmen rode with their faces covered intensified the black population's suspicions and fear. A fear that became ingrained within their culture, and in some aspects still remain amongst many today. It of course wouldn't take long for the tomfoolery to turn to hatred and violence. Displays of human aggression that soon descended into an extremely dark place. Whippings were initially used, but within months there were bloody clashes between Klansmen and the black population. This undoubtedly maintained a segregation and dual culture within the South. Northerners who had come South following the Civil War, or in fact many Southern Unionists, saw the intention of the Klan for what it was, essentially from the start. In 1865, the creation of the Reconstruction era was firmly established. All 11 of the former Confederate states had been rebuilt on extremely lenient terms, and this allowed many of the ex-rebel leaders to quickly return to positions of power. This allowed echoes of the Confederacy to echo through Southern culture and remain in their psyche unchallenged. What had the war realistically accomplished for the long term? What were the repercussions from the outcome? Southern state legislatures began enacting laws that made it clear that the aristocrats who ran them intended to yield none of their pre-war power or dominance over the poor white element of society, and especially over the black population. These newly established laws became known as the Black Codes. They amounted to a virtual re-enslavement of black people in the views of many. Did you know that in Louisiana, the Democratic Convention firmly determined that, quote,
"We hold this to be a government of white people, made and to be perpetuated for the exclusive benefit of the white race, and that the people of African descent cannot be considered as citizens of the United States."
The states of Mississippi and Florida enacted a selection of particularly vicious anti-black codes too, and other southern states would follow suit, passing their own similar laws. President Andrew Johnson did nothing on a federal level to prevent them from being enacted or enforced. These anti-black laws were followed by violence and hostility that would erupt against the black population in the American South, and which outraged many northerners. Those Northerners celebrated victory in the Civil War earlier that same year over both the Confederacy and its system of slavery. In protest of the defiant Black Codes, the U.S. Congress refused to seat the newly elected Southern state representatives when it would eventually reconvene in December 1865, following their recess during the war. the stage was seemingly set for another showdown between Northerners who were determined not to be pushed back on one of their core beliefs of the victory, and the diehard Southerners who refused to give up their views of white supremacy over the black population. The increasingly violent activities of the Ku Klux Klan throughout 1866 only proved the argument of radical Republicans in the North, which was entirely ironic. They believed that harsher measures should be taken against Southern governments as part of their program to force equal treatment for black people. In fact, those radical Republicans eventually won substantial victories in the congressional elections of 1866. This was seen, at least partly, as a result of the Klan violence in news reports of the time. At the start of 1867, a fresh start at Reconstruction was made, and in March of 1867, Congress overrode President Johnson's veto and passed the Reconstruction Act, which abolished the ex-Confederate state governments and thus divided 10 of the 11 former rebel states into military districts. The military governors of these districts were charged with enrolling black voters and holding elections for new constitutional conventions in each of the 10 states. This subsequently led to the creation of the Radical Reconstruction Southern governments. By early 1868, stories about Klan activities were appearing regularly in news reports across the nation and even internationally, triggering Reconstruction governors to realize that they faced a considerable insurrection by a domestic terrorist organization. It was the same year that official orders from the Union Army and state capital governments to finally take down the Klan and suppress its hatred. But was it too late? Had the Klan gained too much power? Well, in some states, yes. In some counties, the Klan became the de facto law. They were an invisible government that state officials could not contain or eradicate. The Klan had infiltrated positions of power too, clandestinely. An alarming example was when Tennessee Governor William G. Brownlow ordered a group of government spies to infiltrate the Ku Klux Klan and report on its organization and activities. Brownlow didn't get very far with what he perceived to be a shrewd and well-enacted plan. This was because the Klan had infiltrated his office and government already. They knew more about his secret plan than he did, which shocked Brownlow. But not as much as when he received news that one of the spies he had tasked with secretly joining the Klan had been murdered. His body was found strung up in a tree with his feet just barely touching the ground. The repercussions for Brownlow's decision didn't stop there. Another spy was stripped naked and mutilated, whilst another was stuffed into a barrel and rolled down a wharf into the Cumberland River in Nashville, Tennessee. He subsequently drowned. With the firm sympathy and support of most white citizens in the South at the time behind them, the Klan worked behind a thick wall that was impossible for Brownlow and other Reconstruction governors to break through. Even though a large majority of white Southerners opposed the radical state governments, not all of them approved of the Hooded Order's brand of vigilante justice either. During its first year, the Klan's public marches and parades were sometimes hooted and jeered at by local townsfolk who looked upon them as a joke organization. But this was early in the existence and would soon change. When the Klan began to use guns and whips to enforce its point and harsh beliefs, there were outcries from some Christian ministers, white newspaper editors, and other civic leaders who spoke out against the violence. The violence had to stop, and it was not acceptable for a supposedly respectable and advanced first world civilization. And while those voices were there and crying out, white Southern voices against the Klan were in the minority at the time. As I stated, the Klan had infiltrated the state governments of the Southern capitals, but as well as that, they had large numbers of newspaper editors, former Confederate officers, political representatives, and religious ministers secretly within its ranks, which gave them significant strength in guiding their actions from a position of great authority and control. General Nathan Bedford Forrest, who was a hugely respected former Confederate cavalry officer, had taken up residence in Tennessee after the Civil War. He joined the Klan fairly soon after it began to make a name for itself, and he was quickly appointed the society's leader. This is only one example of the Klan's propagandic strength at the time. Forrest was the Klan's first quote-unquote Grand Imperial Wizard. He travelled all over the South in the late 1860s, establishing new chapters and quietly providing militaristic and operational advice to its members. During the early years of the Klan, and as the violence would soon escalate, things turned to general lawlessness in some areas. But a power struggle within the Klan itself also emerged at this time in the late 1860s. Some Klan groups began fighting each other, almost forming an internal gang culture amongst different wards of the organization. In Nashville, for example, a gang of outlaws who adopted the Klan's uniform came to be known as the Black Ku Klux Klan. Tennessee saw the emergence of a guerrilla war between the real Klan and bogus unofficial outfits. Congress and the state governments were attacking and adding further pressure on the KKK, even with their inside support. It's believed that the leaders saw the writing on the wall for the Klan at this stage and knew that its dispersal was imminent. Or at the very least, they would need to go underground to protect their interests. Thus, former General Nathan Forrest ordered the Klan to disband in January of 1869. Now, for those of you that know your history, or if there are any historians listening, you may disagree slightly with this. A surviving document written in Forrest's hand is rather ambiguous. Some think Forrest's order of disbandment was just a ruse by Forrest so that he could deny any responsibility or knowledge of further Klan atrocities. And that may have been the case, as even though the Klan disbandment order had been written, many of the organization were firm in their beliefs and went on regardless. Whatever the actual date, it is clear that as a structured, cohesive body across the Deep South, the Ku Klux Klan had ceased to exist in an official format by the end of 1869. As I mentioned, this did not entirely end things though, and the violence continued within Southern society. Atrocities became more widespread, in fact, and radical legislatures throughout the region began to pass very restrictive laws in some Klan-dominated regions of the states affected. Some state governments even set up groups to actively hunt Klan leaders and members in the 1870s. By 1871, Congress held hearings on the Ku Klux Klan and passed a firm anti-Klan law that was modeled after a North Carolina statute. Under the new federal law, Southerners lost their jurisdiction over the crimes of assault, robbery, and murder, and it was the president who was authorized to declare martial law and suspend the writ of habeas corpus. A strict and harsh decision and law that was seen as a huge step for Congress to take. In particular, night riding and the wearing of masks in public was now expressly prohibited. Hundreds of Klan members were arrested as a result, although very few would actually be sent to prison. Whilst the appetite wasn't strong for imprisoning all of the Klansmen in the South for fear of strengthening the organization's interest or popularity, the actions taken were enough to significantly dampen the enthusiasm for the KKK. It wasn't the laws who were solely responsible for muffling the Klan, though. The Southern government certainly can't take credit for that, as much as they would like to. By the mid-1870s, white Southerners didn't need the Klan as much as before, because they had, by that time, retaken control of most Southern state governments. Klan terror was unnecessary. They had legal means of dealing with their beliefs and issues. Those being, keeping black voters away from the polls. Some black office holders were actually hanged and many more were brutally beaten. So not entirely legal means. White Southern Democrats won elections easily and then passed laws taking away the rights that black citizens had won during the Reconstruction era. The result was a system of segregation which was officialized at government level and it became the law for more than 80 years. The system was called, quote-unquote, separate but equal. I suppose this was half true. Everything was certainly separate, but nothing was equal, and the black community would have to go through hell on earth to obtain that equality back. In the next episode, we will talk about that fight for equality and the second significant rise of the Ku Klux Klan in the United States of America. We will discuss if it ever really went away, and how right-wing racism in the United States is on the rise once again. Good night, everyone.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.